He was gaining yet another few tenths of a second on them. But occasionally at night, Cassidy would sit over his training calendar, and the full weight of it would descend on him as he stared at the figures. At those times, he dared to wonder if it really was too much. He would think of the comradeship of Doobie Hall, the horseplay, the unpredictable silliness. His world now had too many sharp corners. He craved the soft contours of the feminine. Surely such longings were natural enough, he thought. Even the buffoonery of Jack Nubbins seemed a far-off entertainment taken too much for granted in happier times. But out on the trails he slipped along in the soggy, warm envelope of his own fierce body heat and needed precisely nothing. At these times, moving silently against the washed-out backdrop of countryside, his mind unfettered except for monitoring the steady 6-minute pace, he went back to his childhood, back to the time of his too-early death. He pondered what it meant, if anything at all. Such a significant event as dying in childhood must take on some meaning in the end, he reasoned, if only a simple safety message, grade school style. This is the watchbird saying, look both ways before crossing the Santa Monica Freeway. But his death seemed to mean nothing. On one of those rain-lashed afternoon runs, Cassidy finally decided that there was a great deal of vanity tied up in his demise, and, in this respect, perhaps Andrea had been right about his obsession. Perhaps it was not excellence he sought at all, but something else entirely. That part he would work on later. It had taken him a long time to arrive at the vanity part. I used to frolic in the salt, salt sea, he thought, and now my toes wrinkle white in this hillbilly mud. When he was very young, he had learned to slip into the sea and plummet like a stone to 50, 60 feet, there to look around leisurely before floating back, calm and haughty in his control of the pale green waters. On rough, sunny days, he would ride his bicycle across the Singer Island Bridge and out to the inlet and scamper among the giant slippery boulders, at ease among the skittering crabs. "What's he doing?" the white-kneed tourists would ask, seeing the waves crashing against jagged rocks so slick no one could even walk on them. "Where are his parents? He'll be drowned." The child would spit into his mask, lean over and rinse it out in the sea. Then grip the spear and wait for the right wave to come bashing frothily among the deadly crags and barnacles. Then, like a spirit, he would slip easily into the receding swell and, with a shiver, be gone. Below, in the sudden quiet, he felt at once peaceful and serene in a terrain he knew better than his own room. The formation of rocks below was home for a school of big red snapper, skittish and crafty, which might let you get off one shot from a distance before disappearing for the day. At the cable crossing there would be sheep's head, easy marks, he ignored them, and schoolmaster snapper. Out toward the tip, closer to the open ocean, the real ocean, one could find just about anything. Some days the sea would be literally alive. Quentin Cassidy had cavorted there like a young seal, sometimes actually feeling an illogical resentment at his addiction to air, a dependence that forced him regularly to make his way wanly to the top, where he endured the noise and neon of an altogether different world. The fishermen, wrinkled, cigar-chomping retirees, cursed him for scaring the fish as they dangled their silly bait randomly in the sea. He felt the hunter's ancient disdain for the trapper. They almost never knew where he was. The other kids were fascinated. They knew the waters, too, but only he was known to go places they would never try and bring back a handful of sand, a rusty nail, a little lump of coral, and show them laughing the simple evidence of his prowess. Quentin Cassidy, at 10, already had his lungs. The others wanted to know the secret. Vitamin Z, he told them, laughing. One time, though, his best friend had pleaded until, when they were alone on the end of the jetty late one afternoon, Cassidy told him, You've got to make yourself calm, right down to the little blood veins in your fingertips. And when you are as calm as you can make yourself, then you make yourself like a rock and start sinking. And the most important thing is that you've got to not care. That's the hard part, the not caring part. And the deeper you go and the colder it gets, the more you have got to not care. And then, when you start back up, back toward real life, then you've got to start caring again. A lot. His father had a 22-foot open fisherman that they took to the islands every summer, and it was Quentin's job to fetch the anchor when it got stuck, silent and unmoving, on some ramp or drop-off far below. "Now, Quenty, it's deep. You'd best put on a tank this time," the old man would say. The old man wore a pipe. He worked in photo engraving at the newspaper. "It's okay, Pop." This as he flipped out of the boat with his mask and snorkel. If his heart raced with excitement of the challenge, he would have to make it slow again like he always did, calming himself, making himself into a rock and then slipping slowly at first, then more rapidly as he went along, down into the darkening green, down to the cold depths where all the mysteries were. When he reached the bottom, he would quickly work the anchor loose, then plant his feet in the sand and shoot upward, streaming bubbles all the way, wondering if he would make it this time. One time, he didn't make it, and died there in the cool green waters. There was a man from another boat on this trip, a lawyer his father knew, and a good diver who had a grouper speared and holed up about 40 feet down. The fellow was too tired to go back down and pull him out. "Hey, Mr. C," he had called, "shame to waste those fillets. Why don't you send that boy of yours down for a try?" They had all heard as much as they wanted to about this little twerp, this little Quenty fish, and there was a distinct challenge in the invitation. His father looked at him resting there on the front platform and said, "Now, Quentin, you're very tired. You've been up and down in 30 feet all day long, so if you don't feel like doing it, you don't have to." But he was poking around for his gear already. The idea of leaving a dying fish tucked up under a coral head to suffer for days nearly made him weep. And he had always made it before, no matter how bad it seemed. And the worse it seemed, the sweeter the air was at the top when he finally broke through and got at it. As he floated on the top, though, looking down to the coral head miniaturized below, he absent-mindedly hyperventilated, thinking how far down it was, how tired he had become. By the time he took his last big gulp of air, his system was all oxygen. He was still peering around under the coral head and taking his time when he realized something was wrong. But by then it was too late. He just barely managed to trip the spring buckle on his weight belt and let the 7 pounds of lead fall to the sandy bottom as he streaked toward the top. He was still 20 feet under when the blackness thundered in. The limp body floated serenely to the top, and there bobbed gaily in the wind chop, looking for all the world like a lazy snorkeler tracking his game. It took a while before the elder Cassidy noticed how remarkably corpse-like little Quentin looked, before he noticed the absence of any motion whatsoever. No little flips for forward motion, no play of the hands to turn or stop. He was saying, "Jesus, Jesus, Jesus," as he slashed the anchor rope with the fillet knife, and cut his own thumb down to white bone at the same time, and then roared over to pull the little gray body from the water, draining seawater from every orifice. There was seaweed in his teeth. It was too much for the old man. It was too final-looking. The bottom of the boat was becoming slick with his own blood as he slid down onto the deck, mumbling. But the others were more efficient. They had seen drownings before and were not so overcome with grief. They began blowing into the fouled little mouth and crushing the ribcage with strong hands. After half an hour, there was some vomiting. He vomited, and then they vomited. But color was coming back, and there was a faint pulse. Finally, some wild thrashing. He had been floating around on the top for perhaps 10 minutes, possibly more, and they had not held out a great deal of hope, even as they frantically worked over him. Then, as he started coming back, although no one said anything, the big fear was that they were rejuvenating a mindless blob that would henceforth sit in some white-walled institution and drool contentedly. But they did not know, could not know, that the cardiovascular system they were priming with their frenzied efforts was capable of withstanding even greater shocks than it had that day. The lungs, the veins and vessels, the resilient throbbing heart. He had them all, even back then. The next day they flew him back across the deep purple Gulf Stream at an altitude of 100 feet. His blood was still so blue they feared to go higher. When he awoke, finally, in Good Samaritan Hospital in West Palm Beach, he wanted to know what had happened to him. His father told him the story again. But every time Quentin went to sleep, he would forget it completely. "Don't you remember, son? Don't you remember diving and..."
"I remember one time. I remember this day I was in the inlet working my way along the rocks at about 30 feet, and this little bull shark about 4 feet long was coming in from the real ocean. He was right in my path, but I didn't move over, just kept swimming straight ahead. When he saw me, he acted like he didn't care, but he moved over a little to let me pass by. I was so ferocious with my sling, Dad, I wasn't afraid. I laughed because he was going so far in, and I knew the hunting was better out near the tip."
Then he held his father, grabbed him and buried his head in the old man's chest, and cried. His father had not seen him do anything like that for a long time. "This one," he thought. "What is it with this one?" Nearly 10 years later, a landbound Quentin Cassidy flew along on the soggy February trails and wondered the same thing. 28. Time. Outside, the afternoon rained on. Cassidy leaned forward and placed all four legs of his chair on the floor carefully. He sighed heavily. The books were stacked up all around, finished and bleak-looking. He was tired of reading. He set his mug down on the table with a grunt. He was tired of tea. He hauled himself to his feet, walked stiffly over to the picture window, a fogged square of chilled gray. He was tired of walking around with his joints creaking like an old man. He had a sudden passing desire for broccoli. Afternoon workout was an hour and a half away, time to begin thinking about it. He was tired of psyching himself for workouts. He was tired of being tired. In reverse mirror script, he wrote on the pane of cold glass, "Help! Imprisoned in February!" Little drops of excess moisture cried down from his letters as he looked out through them and waited for time to pass. He stared out for a long time. 29. 24 in the rain. It had not been so awfully hard on Andrea Cleland, as she was beginning to tell herself lately. She had ended a few difficult relationships in the past, but she was a very mature young lady, and she managed. It was her maturity, in fact, that probably caused some of the distress. She was often a little too far ahead of the game to really take it seriously. Though she had believed herself in love several times, it did not take her long to assay the true metal of the relationship. Before Cassidy, she had begun to have some confidence in her ability to judge that most complex and shifty element in human dealings, motive. It was not as if she had not had experience with ambitious men, or, more accurately, ambitious boys. She knew very well when she was being sized up as a future charming hostess by the president of some fraternity, some bright, good-looking fellow who was easy to like and whose father owned an office supply outfit in Orlando. She chafed a little, but played the role. It was her sensitivity that made her more mature, gave her an edge over her hapless pursuers, and allowed her to set the boundaries. When it was over, she knew it first. And though she might grieve truly, it was a bittersweet emotion because, though sorry, she was always sure of herself. She played hearts like fiddles. And now, this had to happen. She realized finally that she had never really understood Quentin Cassidy very well, that she had tried to use her past experience to take his measure, and it didn't work. "His circuitry is all different," she told her twin sister. His ambition differed in essence as well as degree. Whereas with others she could tell the point at which she might assert certain proprietary rights, the very first hints of nesting behavior, with this runner there was never any question about her rearranging his priorities. This rankled her from the start. She might have the ability to make him miserable, perhaps, but she swayed him not an inch from his path. He told her as much, and she found out quickly he meant it. There was something in the ferocity of his dedication that challenged the formula of her femininity. She responded to the challenge without even realizing she was doing so. To Quentin Cassidy, who knew little about women in general and less about Andrea in particular, their meandering, half-hearted breakup was a thing without reason. It would not abate with discussion, not be cured by soul-searching, not be resolved by agreement. They both recognized certain deep feelings that couldn't be denied, so why, Cassidy asked again and again, all these problems? She found it impossible to tell him that this simply wasn't the way she had imagined it would be. She was not experienced enough to know that it rarely is. Cassidy thought that it was entirely fitting that all the underpinnings of his world should collapse at one time. When he took to the woods and his first nearly total solitude, it was almost with relief. At first, it was. The huge oak in front of Andrea's sorority house was over 300 years old, had been an arm's thickness when Seminole Indians camped in the spot where the sorority house now stood, had shaded weary Spanish cowboys who kept herds on Payne's Prairie not 5 miles from there. This was at a time when a muddy, mosquito-infested fort named St. Augustine was a fledgling mission. Now this old tree kept the steady rain off Quentin Cassidy, standing there in the night, heat mist rising from his body, feeling anything but historic. He loved this old tree, and as he leaned against the incredibly gnarled trunk, he thought, "What does this old fella care about at all?" The strength of the ancient tree somehow soothed his misery. The body heat from his run would keep him warm for a while longer, then he would start to get chilled and have to get moving again to stay warm. His bright nylon shorts and yellow T-shirt hung on him like colorful mud. He was drenched clear through to his childhood. At last he saw them drive up. They were laughing about something as they shared an umbrella to the porch. When the guy kissed her, Cassidy felt a stab of pain that was close to physical, and therefore within the penumbra of hurts he told himself he could bear. As she turned to go inside, Cassidy called to her. The fellow, peering out from under his umbrella, stopped halfway down the sidewalk and squinted toward Cassidy in the shadows of the old tree. The umbrella man looked grim. It appeared his duty was not yet finished. At first, unsure of himself, he finally opted to return to the porch. Cassidy stepped out of the gloom and the porch light fell on him, gleaming in the rain. He called again. "Quentin!" She was afraid she sounded a little too excited to see him. Then she remembered Umbrella Man, who was still coming. "It's all right, George. I'll see you Saturday." Still looking grim, he stalked back to his car and drove off. He had seen the way she ran out there in the rain like that, up to that crazy galoot in the gym shorts, who was supposed to be out of the picture. "Cass, what in the world are you doing?" She gestured in a general manner, taking in the rain, the night, the silliness of it all. She seemed amused.
"Thought I would come to see you."
"But you're drenched. You've been standing..."
"I saw your light wasn't on, so I decided to wait for a while."
She tilted her head in amusement, like she used to do all the time, and finally put her arms around him. He seemed not to know what to do. She was getting drenched now, too, but seemed not to notice. She thought, he's harder now, even than before,
all cartilage and bone and skin. She wondered if he was eating right. Perhaps he would make himself sick. Something moved deep inside her, and she had to stifle it willfully.
I guess I was missing you, he said with his chin on her wet forehead. And I suppose I got sick and tired of it all and just bolted on in here.
Something occurred to her, and she leaned back away from him.
You ran here.
It sounded like an accusation. He was puzzled.
You ran into town from out there, 12 miles, and it's been raining like crazy all...
I don't have a car out there, and...
Cass, you ran 12 miles in the rain to get here, and you're going to have to run 12 miles back, unless you call a cab or something.
He appeared unconcerned.
It's my over-distance day anyway.
Listen, Andrea, I wanted to talk to you because...
Are you listening?
She was shaking her head.
Yes,
she said softly.
The last time, we seemed to be like strangers. I've been feeling so horrible about the whole thing, I just get so frustrated that we can't seem to get anything straight.
Cass, I thought we had been all through that.
I just keep thinking there must be some way to put it, some way that would allow you to understand.
I think I understand.
She looked into his eyes and thought that though once they seemed to balance the hardness of the rest of him, now they added to it.
I think I've always understood, she said. I just don't think I can live with it. Sometimes it seems too much for you, too.
He looked down, shook the rain from his forehead. She was nearly drenched now, too.
Don't you want to come in? She asked.
No, I'll be going, I guess. I'm starting to get chilled.
Cass, she said, pulling him to her again, what is this all going to get you? You've dropped out of school, you're not going to graduate with your class, you...
I ran a 358.6 mile the other night.
What?
No race or anything. Just Bruce out there with a stopwatch and me at 10 o'clock at night. I had to go around the joggers even. Funny, I always dreamed how it would be going under 4 the first time. Lining up, the pace, how the crowd would get excited when we came through the 3 quarters under 3 minutes.
He looked at her with a sad little smile.
But there it was. Just me and Bruce, and a bunch of joggers wondering what in the hell was going on. Just another goddamn workout.
There was something that sounded vaguely like satisfaction in his voice.
Quentin, why don't you come back into town? Where does it say you have to live like this, make yourself miserable like this?
It'll all be over soon anyway. I'll be running Walton next month.
And then what? You've already said you can't win. Even your exalted Bruce Denton says that. So then what do you do? Go back to your little cave and keep driving yourself until you are the one they talk about, the one they are afraid of? Is that what's important to you? Or maybe you'd be content to just go crazy trying. Then no one could say you compromised, could they? If something inside you just snapped.
He looked down. She knew then he would not fight with her. Then she did something that was not quite her and that did not work very well. It was a mistake, and she knew it right away, but it was such a precisely feminine gesture that it was perhaps dictated by some ancient genetic pattern she was helpless to control. With a pained little toss of the head, she wrenched free and ran toward the porch. It was one of those shabby, you'd better come after me now gestures, and she knew by the time she got to the porch that it was a bad show all the way around. She turned to call, to try to take it back, perhaps. But the runner had disappeared in the darkening rain.
30. Whirlpool.
Mary Lou Hunsinger sat in the gurgling whirlpool, checking her eyeliner in a small mirror. Outside, it still rained like a bitch. At that very moment, somewhere out in the glistening night, a homeward-bound Quentin Cassidy came upon, was startled by, and hopped over a poor black snake trying to keep from drowning by crawling up to the high ground represented by State Road 26.
Cassidy was just about halfway home. Mary Lou's frown, of late an almost permanent fixture on her otherwise attractive face, was now a pouty badge of impatience at Dick Doobie, whom she thought rather a clod. On the home front, her mother would be getting dinner for her two slope-headed sons, which meant that by the time she finally arrived, they would be as mean as a pack of starving blue jays. Mary Lou knew very well that, as evil as the boys were, her mother was a shrew in her own right. She didn't even mean well. She considered these bubbly interludes more or less in the line of duty. Not that she didn't take some basic carnal pleasure in them, but they required massive re-vetting of her expensively maintained hairdo. For all of its architectural integrity, her beehive tended to sag in this steamy sanctum, in much the same way as Mary Lou's own flagging hopes. In this surreal chamber he brought her all manner of world weariness, from his cold, church-crazed wife to the latest technical esoterica of his chosen profession. She bore it all with goodwill and no small effort to comfort and counsel. But what, after all, was she supposed to know about the weak side linebacker's responsibility in defensing the quarterback option out of the wishbone? As to the other, she had no difficulty whatever in flatly recommending that Doobie drop his dry-hole little bitch in order to take up with Mary Lou herself in some kind of more widely sanctioned arrangement. It was a scenario she had come to think of as the only non-felonious way she would ever get out from under those killing monthly payments to five trusting department stores, two friendly small loan companies, and the master charge, all of which her former mate, a two-fisted bourbon-crazed paint and body man, had been so thoughtless as to leave as his only enduring legacy. "Pain and body men's like a nationwide brotherhood, hon," he would warn ominously. "I could be in Tucson on Wednesday, pulling down $150 a day like that." He would snap his stained fingers cockily. "Like doctors," he would say, "always in demand." When he finally did take off, he had sense enough not to go to Tucson. The powdery pink flamingo on the front lawn now seemed a mocking reminder of more opulent days when she had nothing better to do than to hop in the station wagon and go shopping to her heart's content. She never looked at the sun-faded little plaster bird standing forlornly on its rusting pipe-stem leg without wondering where it was exactly she had gone so wrong. They never mentioned this in Home Ec. Wrestling with the viscous mathematical intricacies of 18% per annum interest compounded monthly in accordance with federal statutes, she was driven first to secretarial work, she hated waitressing, and thence to Dick Doobie's private whirlpool. The head coach finally arrived and let himself in with his own key. The strain of his staff meeting was still on his face. He apologized with the profuse sincerity of a man unquestionably willing to debase himself in order to maintain a good thing.
"That's all right, honey," she said. "I got nothing better to do but sit here and get my little love button parboiled."
A flash of uncomplicated lust shot through Dick Doobie's loins as she giggled at her own line. Doobie noticed that she had brought a quart bottle of Southern Comfort, which now sat on the moist floor beside an open can of ginger ale. He made a grimace. She watched him undress with contained distaste. He had long ago lost the trimness that was a byproduct of his athletic days. His arms and neck were unattractively sunburned to the edges of his short-sleeved shirt, much in the manner of a gas station attendant. His stomach rolled around loosely, the result of his long afternoons on the high-pyramidal coaching tower, looking stern while drinking Budweiser, hidden in a styrofoam Gatorade holder, ostensibly surveying his minions scattered about the 25-acre practice fields, a general watching his field commanders through powerful binoculars, but in actuality keeping a rather dutiful eye on Simmons Hall, the nursing school dormitory, where one could, were one extremely diligent, catch an occasional flash of nubile young breast or mouth-watering young thigh. Dick Doobie loved his work. He simply couldn't understand why some critics would wish to cause him anguish by suggesting that he was not doing a good job and should go away. He sincerely suspected communist influence of some kind. When he had finally shed his damp garments and was settling his white bottom slowly into the scalding water opposite Mary Lou, he had managed to put out of his mind the distress of his latest staff meeting, where he had unhappily discovered once more that his staff was almost as much in the dark as he was. Football was becoming a damned complicated game, and Doobie figured there was probably some foreign influence behind that as well. Some people were suggesting that they get soccer players to kick field goals. It was madness.
"How did it go, hon?"
she asked, shifting around to allow room for his considerable bulk. He was almost settled now, leaning back and heaving a sigh of relief.
"Oh, shit, honey, I don't know. I wanted that stump fucker Erickson to read up some on this new wishbone formation. Remember the one I told you about where they can shift from weak side to strong side and run an option off of the... No?
Honey, I just told you about it last week.
Well, goddamn, Angel, you know I don't remember that kind of stuff very well.
Oh, well... It don't matter anyway, he said, sinking now to his neck in the roiling water. I'll just have to do it myself like everything else.
He smiled at that and began probing for her with his big toe.
Now, honey, don't you want a drink or something? She asked.
Of that sweet horse piss?
He continued probing. She dodged with precision as her sex learns to do at an early age in the Republic. A thought struck her.
Hon, I finished typing that talk for tomorrow. It's on your desk if you want to take it home tonight.
Christ almighty, I forgot about that altogether.
The misery he had almost shed now settled on him again, and Mary Lou was sorry she had said anything.
I wish I had some way to get out of that thing, he said mournfully.
Why do you have to do it?
Old man Prigman, required it. Told me I'd never make conductor until I could face my own music. But Lord, standing up there in the plaza while a bunch of them snippy, long-haired twats ask a bunch of asshole questions. Most of 'em don't even go to football games.
I thought that stuff was over.
Over, hell. They still got that, whatever they call it, conscription of athletes or whatever the hell they call themselves. Prigman said there wasn't a goddamn thing we could do about it except ignore it. Can you beat that? Here in America, and you can't do anything about people getting together to badmouth football.
Why can't you get rid of them?
Prigman said if we didn't nip it in the bud with that damn track guy, we would have to learn to live with it. Said we couldn't start throwing all of them out. It'd look too bad in the press. But boy, if I was running the show.
He rubbed his hands over his bristly head as if in some deep pain.
They keep issuing these mother-loving press releases. Jesus!
Oh, honey, she said, taking his left foot, massaging gently.
Slowly, she worked her way up the hairy calf.
There's gotta be something to do. I can't keep up with this stuff and operate a goddamn ass-kicking football team at the same time. That's more than a full-time job by itself. More than full-time.
Now, come on, honey, she said softly, still working upward. We don't have to talk about that stuff all evening, do we? Let's talk about something else.
Dick Doobie loosened with a moan under the onslaught of her simple ministrations. The toe probed feverishly.
"What do you want to do, hon?"
he murmured softly.
"What do you want to do, Angel?" she cooed back as he began sinking lower and lower until finally his mouth was almost awash in the swirling water.
"Play alligator."
He smiled evilly as his hot, beady eyes slowly disappeared beneath the surface. 31. Irish Highs. When no one answered his knock, Bruce Denton wiped his muddy feet on the filthy welcome mat and went into the cabin. He was accustomed to the disarray, but surprised to see a bottle of Bushmills Irish whiskey open on the big cable spool that served as a kitchen table. He walked over, placed the cap back on the bottle, and picked up the book lying beside it. It was a soft cover copy of In Our Time. He smiled.
"Hey, Nick," he called. "You in here, Nick?"
"Very funny,"
Quentin Cassidy croaked from behind a stack of paneling. He lay just under the front window, parallel to it, almost completely obscured by the lumber. Denton walked over and sat down on the stack of wood. Cassidy smiled up at him, a coffee mug rising and falling on his chest. It contained several nearly melted ice cubes and probably no coffee, Denton surmised.
"So," Denton let the word hang. "I thought you were coming out here yesterday, jerk,"
Cassidy said pleasantly.
"Ah, yes, well, sorry about that. Jeannie got to feeling bad and I ran her by the infirmary. We are, waiting for word on the rabbit, or whatever it is they do these days. When I got back, it was dark, so I decided to come today."
"Oh, pitter-patter of little spikes around the house."
Cassidy yawned, did not appear very interested.
"So, what's the occasion? Or am I being too personal?"
"Occasion? Since when does a fellow have to have an occasion to bend an elbow?"
Cassidy asked. Denton knew that Cassidy drank a lot of beer, but had never seen him take anything harder. He was partially amused, partially alarmed, but only the amusement showed.
"Doing a little reading, huh? What's this?"
He picked up the paperback folded open beside Cassidy and turned it over to look at the cover. It showed a young man sitting on a bench in a locker room putting on tiger training flats. Behind him, an older man stood, towel around his waist, as if he were about to yank it off with a cry of, "Looky here!" Cassidy giggled at him.
"That, my friend, is a book that explores a much overlooked and steadily growing athletic minority, the homosexual distance runner."
"Oh, yeah?"
Denton was leafing through the book.
"What's the main, I mean, what do they, you know, do?"
"I can see, sir, that you are a man of little sophistication. These fellows train themselves to a fine edge while maintaining dalliances with their ex-marine coaches. They fatten themselves up on yogurt and walnuts, and then they go out and run fantastic races, despite the overwhelming social pressures brought to bear."
"Oh, yes. They also rip off 57-second quarters in morning workouts. But mostly..."
He got up on his elbows so he could look Denton in the eyes.
"Mostly they kind of lay around the locker room admiring each other's tawny hamstrings."
He giggled again.
"Hmm. Is this some latent prejudice of yours finally making its way out of the closet? I thought you were one of those put-it-into-whatever-you-want-or-whoever-you-want kind of fellas. Look, my view of sexual matters is that consenting adults should be allowed to run over each other with hay balers if that's their fondest desire. So long, of course, as they don't do it in front of the children. Or lovers of harvesting equipment."
Denton nodded, but he seemed engrossed in a passage in the book. His forehead wrinkled as he read for a few moments. Finally, he tossed the book back on the floor.
"Whew," he said. "See what I mean? Now, really, what does how you get your jollies have to do with anything? So what if I'm out here whipping my wire 15 times a day? Who cares?"
Yes, well, I see you're a little overwrought about this. Overwrought? Hell, I'm drunk as a skunk. He giggled again. I'm so fine-tuned I get blipped from a tumbler of Dr. Pepper.
Denton couldn't help laughing.
How about the Hems, Michigan stories I brought? He gestured back toward the table. Yes, I like them pretty much, except for all the stiff upper lip crap. But the guy went out and did things, you know? I mean, you could tell he really did those things, knew about them before going out and shooting his mouth off. He just sat down and tried to tell it as honestly as he could. That's a shitload better than sitting around New York with a bunch of other artistes diddling each other and writing about the state of being Jewish, or how anguishing it is to be an anguished writer. But then again...
His elbows were tiring. He flattened out on the floor again.
Who cares? Who cares indeed? Cassidy sighed.
Denton thought, here is a man who's been alone too long.
Christ, Bruce, I've got to get out of this hole. Take me to some food, to a place with people I can snarl at, waitresses in pantyhose, a place with that hallmark of civilization, a salad bar with fake bacon bits.
Just what I had in mind, assuming you can walk.
Steady there, Denton said.
Cassidy was struggling stiffly to his feet.
Did you run today? Denton asked, helping him up. Can a fish tread water? Hell yes, I ran today. You think I'm out here to taunt the farmers? I'm going to take a shower.
Denton saw the training calendar on the floor where Cassidy had been lying. He picked it up and studied it for a moment, finally letting out a low whistle.
What in the hell were you doing running 34 goddamn miles yesterday? Are you going bonkers or what?
Cassidy stuck his head out of the bathroom.
I ran into town last night. See, I thought my good friend and coach was going to be coming out to do a workout with me, and he didn't show up, see? Ah, hell. I went to see Andrea. It was a mistake.
Okay, fair enough. I won't stand you up anymore. I know this is rough out here sometimes, but I thought the Andrea business was all over with, wasn't it? But the bathroom door was closed. In the shower, Cassidy crooned off-key,
"And all of us here are just more than contented to be livin' and dyin' in three-quarter time."
Cassidy was still in a good mood as they drove into town. Denton switched on the windshield wipers as they hit a mild shower. The intensity of the rains had waned lately.
"Now, if you'll settle back," Denton said, "I'll give you a rundown on the news. It's short and not very pleasant."
Denton began telling Cassidy about the organization formed by campus athletes called Coalition of Southeastern University Athletes. Its express purpose was talking, negotiating, and otherwise dealing with the Athletic Association, Denton told him. When the group announced its formation, the media blitz that had so disrupted Dick Doobie's life at the time of the awesome midnight raid returned with a vengeance. Sports writers rankled at the idea of an athletes' union and wanted to know how conditions could be so bad as to necessitate collective bargaining in jockdom. No one, least of all Dick Doobie, was able to provide a satisfactory answer. The athletes simply told reporters that, as the writers did not live in the regime, they could hardly understand the zeitgeist. More meetings were held, statements were released. Quentin Cassidy, who had apparently disappeared altogether, was eulogized as a martyred saint or damned as a self-serving rabble-rouser. There had been editorial comment on some sports pages, Denton told Cassidy, that would boggle your noodle. A progressive commentator at the Pensacola News Journal suggested capital punishment for ungrateful student-athletes.
"What it boils down to," Denton said, flipping the wipers off, "is they have scratched you from the list of competitors at the Southeastern Relays."
"What?"
"That's it. Now, please don't ask me to make any sense out of it. I am simply reporting the facts. Apparently, there is no rationale behind it except, getting back at you."
"Are you serious about this?" Very.
They are not going to let me run?
Nope.
Did they say why for Jesus goddamn Christ's sake?
Now don't go taking it out on me. I'm just telling you what Cornwall told me. For what it's worth, he doesn't like it any more than you. He didn't even know at first how they found out you were running in the thing. Then he figured Hairlep or one of the guys at the Sun went running to Doobie when they got the advance lists of competitors. You know how objective the old Fourth Estate is when it comes to sports. Anyway, Doobie himself apparently has authorized a policy that says Quentin Cassidy will not be permitted to compete on Southeastern University's benighted track come hell or high water.
My Lord in heaven.
Cassidy sat looking miserably out the window at the wet fields.
Can they do this?
Who knows? They're doing it. I asked my lawyer friend Jerry Schakow what he thought about it, but he said he couldn't tell without doing some research. He said it presents an interesting question.
Swell.
Meanwhile, not to worry. Training goes full bore. I'm going to start coming out in the afternoons more often to keep tabs on your interval work. You concentrate on the running, and let me worry about getting you onto the track. But Cassidy was despondent. He sat with arms folded, shaking his head in disbelief as he watched the fields and scrub forests pass. They finally reached Art's Steakhouse at the edge of town. Denton slapped him on the knee jovially. All right now, let's get us some dinner and try to think pleasant thoughts. I might even have an Irish whiskey myself.
I wouldn't recommend it, Cassidy said glumly. It seems to conjure up evil humors.
Bruce Denton rarely disclosed all he knew at one time. With Cassidy, he preferred to let important information come out in dribbles, as if by accident. He knew intuitively that such intelligence, invested with self-discovery, retained hard lines in a sometimes blurry world. But as to his courageous attempt to intervene with higher authority, no less than old man Prigman himself, he chose to say nothing at all. Not that he was embarrassed by the comic futility of his effort, but he now realized the true nature of his adversary and decided to keep his own counsel while considering new tactics. He schemed with the controlled joy and abandon of a supposedly reformed street fighter suddenly finding himself in a brawl not of his own making. He had gained his audience with Prigman in a very practical manner. He made himself an extremely good-natured pest. He sat around the waiting room reading old copies of Florida Rancher, grinning cheerfully at Roberta, cracking his gum like a blissful field hand. The secretary, who liked her office uncluttered, could not handle it. When she typed three errors in the same sentence in an obsequious letter to the governor, she calmly got up from her desk, marched into the inner sanctum, and pleasantly demanded action. Once in the door, Denton, had he not known better, might have thought Stephen C. Prigman had been sitting around for hours in delightfully sweaty anticipation of his arrival.
"Bruce Denton!"
Prigman wrung his hand heartily.
"Now this is a surprise."
"How do you do, sir?" Denton smiled despite himself. "Why can't they deal with this man?" he thought.
"I hope you received my telegram after your wonderful victory."
"Oh, yes, sir. It was one of the first to arrive." Denton lied happily. This was going to be easier than he thought.
"Fine, fine. You know, I've been meaning to have you and Jennifer over for dinner one night, but this job..."
He tossed his hands, a man who could only hope those folks he truly liked could understand why he had such scant time for them. Denton wondered who the hell Jennifer was. "Of course, sir, I know how terribly busy you must be, so I wouldn't presume upon your time unless..."
"No problem, no problem at all, my boy. I have all the time you need."
To prove as much, he glanced nervously at his watch.
"So, what is it I can do for you?"
"Well, sir, it concerns a young man named Quentin Cassidy." Prigman's face drooped so noticeably that Denton stopped, surprised. So, Prigman was in on it.
"Oh,
said the old man quietly, settling back in his chair.
Yes, sir. I understand that he is not being allowed to participate in the Southeastern Relays next month, and...
Prigman squirmed in his chair, an adolescent movement, full of irritation and not at all in character.
"Might I inquire," he interrupted Denton, "as to the reason for your personal concern in this matter?"
He had shifted, in the subtle manner of Southerners of his species, from diplomacy to advocacy, disguising the maneuver with such sincerity and deference as to leave the object of his charm, whether hostile witness or cautious subordinate, unsuspecting until it was too late.
"Well, sir, Mr. Cassidy is a friend of mine. I have been helping him with his training for some time now, and I feel he might be an outstanding competitor, perhaps even of Olympic caliber, given the right opportunities. I can't understand what possible reason there might be, and I know about the recent, difficulties. Possible reason, that is, for keeping him out of the upcoming...
Now, Bruce, may I call you Bruce? This whole affair has been extremely unfortunate for everyone concerned. Extremely unfortunate. But I'm sure that you, being an athlete yourself, must understand that insubordination must be dealt with firmly. Now, I know some mistakes have been made on both sides, but in the final analysis, rules are rules. Perhaps your sport is somewhat different, being individual and all, but on the playing field there must be a supreme commander, a leader who must make life or death decisions right on the spot. A game can be won or lost on a split second's hesitation. There is no other way to function, my boy. If you had to gather a football team together to take a vote on every play, why, there would be chaos, anarchy. Pretty soon the cheerleaders would want to vote, too. This democracy stuff just won't cut it on the gridiron, my boy. Now, in track and field, I don't know.
Sir, respectfully, I don't think anyone has suggested anything of the kind. If someone had taken the time to talk with Mr. Cassidy, they would have seen he was not advocating, nor anyone else who signed the petitions, anything other than stopping petty harassment and invasion of privacy of the athletes.
It's all a matter of discipline, following orders. Dick Doobie may not have been right all the time, but he was still Dick Doobie, the general. He gave orders. And then what happened? Petitions.
He said it as if pronouncing the name of some loathsome disease that had just claimed a loved one.
"I suppose," said Denton very quietly, "that I just don't happen to subscribe to the militaristic sports metaphor. I don't believe that a football field or a basketball court are battlefields, except to the most simplistic and unenlightened observers. Even granting the analogy, I don't think a general at war would go out and order his army to eat shit just for the hell of it. Sir." Denton had a vague notion he was no longer being listened to. Sports and religion in the Deep South, he thought. When his last remark got no discernible response, he knew his time was up. Prigman was concerning himself with the lighting of a huge cigar.
"Well?" the old man said at last, turning slightly to the side so as to look out his window across the windswept plaza. "At any rate, such insubordination and dissension cannot be tolerated among athletes. You have no idea the damage this whole affair has caused, not just to team morale, but to this university. I'm speaking in terms of our image among the people of the state of Florida. No idea."
Denton stood before the giant desktop, looking across at the gray, dapper old Politico behind it. He had thought that surely sweet reason could be brought to bear, that somewhere an appeal might be fairly heard. But then Denton was unencumbered by the knowledge of Stephen C. Prigman's illustrious career as a jurist, and therefore was not prepared to meet an intellect capable of operating almost wholly in a bygone century.
"Sir,
Quentin Cassidy has represented this institution honorably and well. He has been the Southeastern Conference mile champion for 2 years and the captain of his team. He holds numerous school records. He has a chance to truly excel now, and keeping him out of this track meet can serve no reasonable purpose whatsoever except...
I take issue with that, said Prigman, exhaling aromatic blue smoke. You say that the boy might become a real blue chipper, eh?
Well, we don't use that term in running, but yes, he might very well become...
Well, he shall not do so using the facilities of this university.
Very final sounding, this last. I was going to say, except possibly for revenge of some kind, Denton said sadly. Prigman was shuffling papers on his desk impatiently. Denton started for the door.
Your committee chairman, Dr. Branham, Prigman said suddenly.
Yes, sir. Prigman was looking away from him as if distracted by something out the window.
Dr. Branham is very anxious for you to finish that dissertation quarter after next. You wouldn't want to get too involved in other matters and let that work slide, would you?
Denton considered simply walking out, but decided to stop. All right, little man, have it your way. But I'm going to go to school on you now, he thought. With a crooked smile, he turned back to Prigman. No, sir, I guess I'd better keep my nose to the old salt mine.
Fine, fine.
Prigman was relighting his cigar, his mind obviously already on other treachery. Denton thought, My Lord in Heaven. 32. The Interval Workout. An interval workout, Cassidy once explained to a sports writer, is the modern distance runner's equivalent of the once popular iron